WRCT Pittsburgh. Real vinyl.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
It's knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk. That makes me.
I'm from Forest and you're listening to 88.3 WRC.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
I want to start today with an explosive confrontation that took place during another one of these Republican Senate hearings. This particular confrontation involved unhinged Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, alongside Teamsters President Sean O'Brien. Teamsters, of course, a union. Republicans tend not to like unions. Republicans love to frame unions as sort of like mob entities, and the guys or gals who run unions as mob bosses. And we've seen that narrative for a while. The big continuing story since Republicans have taken over control of the House is the humiliating, face-planting, and self-destructive nature of these hearings, the hearings that Republicans have organized. And this is happening in the House and the Senate on big and crossover hearings as well, on big tech, on weaponization of the justice system, or whatever the case may be. And even when it is not Republicans who organize the hearing, they still find new ways to humiliate themselves. So let's take a look at this video. Bernie Sanders was sort of trying to officiate this thing, and it is the latest brazen attempt by Republicans to attack labor, which is what they love to do.
You talk about CEOs that are making all this money. And what do you make, Mr. O'Brien?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question.
Yeah, I know what you make, because in 2019, your salary was, $193,000? I'm sure you got some pay raises since then.
Yeah, when I was around.
And the average you.
So basically like the same salary as Mark Wayne Mullen gets as a senator. That's an interesting thing. A little higher.
PS driver, the feeder driver makes $35,000 a year? What do you bring?
That's inaccurate.
Hold on a second.
That's inaccurate. State
no,
facts.
I got it right here.
State facts. That's inaccurate.
The average UPS feeder driver makes $35,000. If you don't know your facts, then maybe you should.
Well, I know them because I negotiate the contract.
So I say one thing to you. What do you bring for that salary?
What do I bring?
Yeah, what job have you committed or have you started? What job have you created? One job other than sucking the paycheck out of somebody else that you want to say that you're trying to provide because you're forced.
So remember, the narrative here is unions are oppressive. The people who run them take money in exchange for nothing other than forcing the workers to pay union dues. And we would all be better off if there were no unions and the workers had a direct relationship with the companies. Now, of course, we know that that's not the case. And we know that as a result of the unions and being able to collectively bargain in this way, the workers actually end up earning more on average, all else being equal. But that's not the story that Republicans like to tell about unions.
And then pay dues. And
no, we don't force
them. Senator, you've asked them.
You're out of line.
Actually, I haven't. And don't tell me I'm out of line.
You are out of line.
Don't tell me I'm out of line.
Well, you frame the statement. Yeah.
Because you don't know
you're
what you're talking about.
You're going to tell me to shut my mouth?
Yes, I did.
Hold it.
Tough guy. I'm not afraid of physical.
Senator, hold it.
But don't sit there and tell me I'm out of line.
Senator.
You made a statement. You asked the question.
I didn't ask a question.
You did it.
I answered the question.
You asked the question about how
much money.
Let him answer.
It was a rhetorical
question.
Well,
you may think it's rhetorical.
It
sounded to me like a question. Let him answer the question.
I'm not yielding my time to him. So if you're going to let me keep my time, that's fine.
You'll have your time. Let him. You ask a question. He has a right to answer that.
As far as my salary goes, my salary, if you follow me around, I actually look at this building. I bet you I work more hours than you do, twice as many hours.
That's impossible. But
no, that's true.
Sir, you don't know what hard work
is.
You want to follow my schedule?
I'll do it in a minute.
That's
we
not,
hold greedy CEOs like yourself accountable.
You call me a greedy CEO.
Oh, yeah, you are. You want to attack my salary, I'll attack yours. What did you make when you owned your company?
I made my company. I kept my salary down at about $50,000 a year because I'm better.
Now, this we all know this game. This is so just I kept my salary down. And of course, as CEO, Mark Wayne Mullen made tens of millions of dollars towards his net worth from non-salary compensation. Typical move. Maybe he thinks nobody else knows that, but we know that game.
Said every penny into it.
OK. All right. You mean you hid money?
No, I didn't hide. Oh, hold on a second.
Okay. So there's a couple different things here that I think are important to mention. One of those things is the general idea that Republicans want to put out there. And I don't even want to say that Republicans believe. They may not believe it. As we know, a lot of this stuff is just performance. The idea that they put out there is that rather than a tool or an infrastructure that allows workers to organize and to pool their negotiating strength in order to obtain better salary and benefits from a situation in which an individual worker has disproportionately little power, right? That's essentially what the union allows workers to do in order to get higher salary and better benefits. The union, they frame as almost like a leech that just collects dues forcibly, which, by the way, often is not the case, that you're forced into the union and to pay dues. In fact, sometimes it's the opposite, where even if you refuse to pay the dues, the union still represents you. But that's a detail and depends on the union. And it takes away value. The idea is, oh, the workers come out with less because not only do they end up having to pay the dues, they don't even get a higher salary or better benefits. We know that that's not the case. I mean, it's been studied endlessly and we know that's not the case. So that's number one. And then number two, with all of these Republicans, some personal hypocrisy is not far behind. And it is not lost on me, and I hope it's not lost on you, the irony or the absurdity of Mark Wayne Mullen calling the Teamsters president with a low six-figure salary the greedy CEO, when the entire point of the Teamsters is to negotiate better pay and benefits for tons of different workers, when Mark Wayne Mullen's net worth and his assets exploded by tens of millions of dollars over the last few years. So they are pathetic, yes. They are hypocrites, yes. But they also have to lie about unions. Now, I am not an unreasonable person when it comes to unions. I recognize that there are lots of small businesses where a union doesn't really make sense. And I am not someone who goes around and says every business should be unionized. That's just not my view. I've not come to believe that that's the best thing. But when you're talking about these organizations with tons of workers, electricians, electricians union, trade unions, for particular companies, UPS, etc., the dynamics of those companies and the sheer scale of those companies are such that there has to be some mechanism for all of these employees who have shared interests to be able to pool their power. Because remember, when there are 30,000, 60,000 employees or whatever the case may be, one person, if forced to negotiate individually, has relatively little power, because they can just be excluded or pushed to the side or their influence minimized. When the negotiation is happening collectively, that is a very different situation. And it puts large companies in the position of having to really come to the table, not necessarily in good faith, but at least willing to negotiate in a real way. So very interesting exchange, and shows the continued hostility towards labor from the modern Republican Party. Republicans are now going to investigate the January 6th investigation. What? Yeah, we knew they would do it. The last Congress saw the House of Representatives January 6th committee. That was a committee which investigated the Trump riots. Republicans for a long time have been saying the committee is the problem. The committee has committed wrongdoing. And now, as expected, there is going to be an investigation of the investigation. NBC News reports Republicans launch an investigation into the January 6th committee that examined the riot. Congressman Barry Loudermilk from Georgia will lead the investigation and was accused by the House's former January 6th panel of giving tours of the Capitol in the days leading up to the riot. So individuals whose connection to the riots is at minimum raising some red flags are going to be doing the investigating into the very committee that looked at some of their own actions. This is an infinite regression to some degree, but it is also maybe one of the most bad faith investigations that Republicans want to take on. The article goes on to say many House Republicans were vocal critics since the creation of the January 6th committee. Yeah, we know. The inquiry seems to make good on lawmaker campaign trail vows to investigate the investigators. Now, understand, this will go nowhere. This is going to go absolutely nowhere. I know that I get some of these emails from the right and see some comments on the YouTube channel about, oh, we're going to put Adam Schiff in prison for that January 6th committee. Jamie Raskin's going to be locked up for the No, they're not. Nobody's going to be locked up. It was a completely reasonable, well-organized, it was actually one of the best investigative endeavors that I've seen the House of Representatives undertake in at least a decade. But they need to virtue signal. They need to show that we are going to do the thing. And it'll sort of end with a fizz rather than a bang. And nothing will happen. A couple of other notes about this. CNN reports some additional details. House Republicans plot new January 6th probes despite internal backlash over Kevin McCarthy giving Tucker Carlson footage. So this is the background to Republicans saying we're going to investigate that January 6th committee. In the background, Republicans are only raising new reasons why they should be the ones investigated. And most recently, it is Kevin McCarthy handing over previously unreleased footage from the January 6th insurrection riot, call it what you want, to Tucker Carlson, to Fox News propagandist Tucker Carlson. We now know, of course, that Tucker Carlson turned that around and used the footage to try to claim, falsely, by the way, that the entire story we were told about January 6th was wrong. Even many Republicans, in responding to Tucker Carlson's bogus narrative that he has played out on national television, I believe it was Monday and Tuesday of this week, even many Republicans have said Tucker's conclusions, Tucker's narrative based on the footage that he aired, doesn't actually follow from the footage. So this is the latest thing. It will probably end on, you know, to people like you and I, we see this stuff and we say, wow, humiliating. Endless resources spent, the virtue signaling and the mouth flapping and the entire thing. And of course, they come up with nothing. It's like Durham, Trump waiting around for months, if not years. Durham's going to expose all the things Democrats. Nothing came of it. Nothing came of it. And that's why these investigations are very loudly announced. And then they end with a fizz because there's really nothing there. If anything, we need a new January 6th committee investigating the alleged and arguable Republican cover-up of January 6th that even includes these recent things over the last few months. What will actually happen as the day-to-day and what confrontations will there be or what would the hearings be like? We'll just have to wait and see. But I am not a betting man, but I would be willing to bet here nothing substantive comes of the investigation into the investigation. If you disagree with me, if you think that the January 6th committee did something wrong or whatever the case may be, let me know in a comment. Let me know in an email. I'd be interested in hearing from you. The David Pakman Show is a viewer and listener funded program, and the easiest way to support the work that we do every day is to sign up for a membership at joinpakman.com. Not only do we do an extra show every day for our members, we provide you with commercial free access in either video or audio format to the daily podcast, as well as that bonus show, And we make it all available to you hours before the shows are publicly launched. We also do members-only town hall events, and we have a member-only soundboard with a lot of the clips that I play.
Globalist. Internationalist.
Okay, yeah, you know those. All of that is available when you become a member at joinpacman.com. And you can finalize our anti-celebration of last weekend's CPAC by using the coupon code CPACTRASH. That's all one word. Lowercase, uppercase, whatever, but it is all one word. CPACTRASH to get yourself a neat little discount off of the cost of a membership at joinpacman.com. I am going to play for you something quite stunning. And this goes to, you know, we've talked before on the program about the pseudo-intellectual and anti-intellectual movement. And this has come overwhelmingly from the American right wing, although sometimes the left engages in it as well. And one of the things that has been a staple, one of the aspects to this that has been a staple from the right, is that thinking too much actually isn't that good. Formal education is little more than liberal indoctrination. And so we shouldn't even really be praising or seeking out intellectualism. But there's another aspect to this, which is making nonsense people out to be intellectuals that they are not. And I have an example of this that is quite stunning. Tucker Carlson introduced an interview that he did with, I guess, former actor and now YouTuber Russell Brand. Tucker Carlson refers to Russell Brand as a public intellectual. Now, I know that will come as a shock to many of you. But what is stunning is that then Russell Brand proceeds to rant completely unintelligibly about COVID for 5 minutes, and Tucker just sits there looking dazed. Take a look at this. There is a lot that I want to talk about from this clip. Let's listen.
So as we told you, we sat down yesterday with Russell Brand, the comedian, actor, and now, frankly, kind of a public intellectual, for about an hour and a half on our show, Tucker Carlson Today. We want to share more of it tonight. In particular, Brand spent a lot of time thinking about and telling us about the COVID lockdowns.
Yeah.
And the point
Russell has thought about it a lot.
Of them was maybe the clearest explanation we have heard of what we've just lived through. Here it is.
I think COVID provided a lens through which we could scrutinize the machinery of power and how the intentions and agenda of power are able to play out, coalesce, and let's call it conspire when a crisis occurs.
Now, remember, there's two things here that might trick right-wingers into thinking that this is deep thought. One is that for the American audience, you know where I'm going. Russell Brand speaks with a British accent, and that actually is quite an effective tool. This applies both to left and right, I hate to say it, into making it sound like someone is actually speaking quite intelligently. The other thing is that he is only feeding back to a lot of these right wingers the things they already believe.
A tendency, a globalist tendency to increase surveillance, a big tech appetite to capture data, and a comparable appetite within government converge. As the great American comedian George Carlin used to say, there is no need for conspiracy where interests converge. It seems that even if at its advent it was a legitimate crisis, and I certainly wouldn't make any contention around that, it was opportunistically handled in order to enhance regulation and control at a time where regulation and control are increasingly difficult to implement as people are more suspicious of institutional power. So in a sense, the best way to understand COVID, I believe, is to take COVID out of it and look at how the institutions both
ignore COVID to understand COVID
and government behaved around it.
Pretend almost like there was no COVID and then be like, well, none of this stuff made sense if you remove COVID from it. Right. Well, but there was COVID.
How did they benefit? How did they utilize it? What narratives did they disseminate, and which narratives did they control and curtail? Even with the recent text messages from our health minister at that time, Matt Hancock, you can explicitly see it was exploited. Oh no, we need to scare people. Is there any way high net worth individuals can get into the country? All these conversations that many people that are cynical about the behavior of the powerful believed were happening were indeed happening. The way that natural immunity was discussed proved to be be true, i.e. that natural immunity is effective. They probably understood earlier than they admitted that natural immunity was effective, and for reasons that...
Note the use of the word probably.
What could it be? What could be the reason that a monetizable solution to COVID was prioritized over a non-monetizable? Is there anyone involved in the situation?
Well, one interesting aspect to that would be the dramatically higher death rate of people who got COVID rather than unvaccinated versus people who got COVID vaccinated. That would be one interesting reason why you would prioritize the vaccination program.
That has a profit motive. Let's look at the data. And that, you know, so what? It was just revelatory, like the apocalypse always will.
And remember, Tucker Carlson hasn't said a word. We're 2 minutes in.
The apocalypse is revelation of all what was always there. Corruption, convergence of interests, alliances. This is not conspiratorial.
No.
This is the moot recital of economic interests and the ordinary movements of the powerful. If people can honour one another and talk to one another in good faith and recognise that anybody is, like, this whole debate between, like, that I've sort of felt a little bit around me even for coming here, I feel like it used to just be normal that someone in your family would be a conservative and someone in your family would be liberal and someone in your family would be socialist and someone in your family would be trans and someone in your family would be gay and different races are coming together. Yes. This is part of who we are. And if it isn't part of who we are, it's certainly...
Okay, so this goes on and on and on and on and on. Okay, so a couple different things here. First of all, most of the things that Russell is saying actually just aren't true. And if you really kind of dissect all of this different stuff, you see there's really nothing there. But I want to zoom out and talk about the framing that Tucker Carlson gave of saying that Russell Brand is now, he's a public intellectual, quite frankly, I think it was, is what Tucker Carlson said. Now, what do we mean by a public intellectual? Many of us can imagine sort of like the academic intellectual, right? This is someone who, this is the caricature, and I understand I'm playing into the caricature, but the idea would be the academic intellectual is someone who, if you put a camera in front of them for a TV show, they're not really good at explaining their ideas and they're not concise and they go on and they talk about their work and their thoughts in a way that is not relatable to the average person. And they are sometimes seen as maybe elite or condescending to the average person or whatever, right? So public intellectual would be, it's someone who is well known and an intelligent, you know, learned person from an academic pedigree of sorts, but who is also contributing their knowledge in the sort of more popular culture, I guess we would say, and is recognized both on the academic side, but also on the non-academic and sort of like media side and by members of society in general. So obviously, by that definition, Russell Brand is not a public intellectual, but the bigger story here for me is I've said before, you know, sometimes Marjorie Taylor Greene will rant somewhere. And I will say to you all, a lot of the American right wing sees her as a thinking person. And Lauren Boebert will rant, or, you know, Ted Cruz will make some statement about a legal precedent during a hearing. And I will say there are a lot of people in the U.S. on the right who see that as what it means to be a thinker. And of course, Russell Brand is very far from really what I would consider to be public intellectuals. Now, public intellectuals today do look and sound a lot different than at times past. So I'll give you some examples of people that I do think are sort of public intellectuals. One that comes to mind, and I was just listening to some of his podcasts, and that's why he's on my mind, Cal Newport. Cal Newport is a PhD computer scientist who teaches at Georgetown. He's been on the show before, who writes both for academic audiences and for general audiences about the sociocultural impacts of technology and so many other things. He's written articles that would be really for an academic audience, and he's also written great popular books like Deep Work and A World Without Email and others. That to me makes a lot more sense as like a modern public intellectual. And when you listen to Cal's podcast, you realize, wow, this is a very different thing than Russell Brand. Cal doesn't have a British accent. I will mention that. Other examples, maybe Jared Diamond, someone who has done a ton of academic work and really deep field work and also has written books for popular consumption. This one, I'm less sure, but someone like Kazuo Ishiguro, the British, Japanese-British writer, Salman Rushdie comes to mind. Camille Paglia, even if you don't like her views, hard to argue that that's not, you know, when we talk about a public intellectual today, that's what we're talking about. Daniel Dennett would be another example. So anyway, it's an interesting thing. I don't know if Tucker is serious when he says Russell Brand is a public intellectual or not. But it's a very interesting phrase to hear him use, particularly when the right has spent a long time sort of deriding the value of public intellectuals until they found someone they can try to pass off as one in order to try to make some kind of political point. Interesting use of that term. This is a crazy story. I thought this was fake when I first heard about it. Lauren Boebert is about to be a grandmother. Now, I know you're saying, wait, Lauren Boebert, how old is she? Lauren Boebert is 36 years old. And she is about to be a grandmother because her teenage son is going to be having a baby next month. And listen, there are a lot of cultural differences between different parts of the country. There's no doubt about that. And it is much less common in parts of the country, more liberal parts of the country, to see something like this celebrated. And I'll tell you why in a moment with some statistics, but Lauren Boebert is celebrating it. Lauren Boebert is acting like it's a good thing that she, as a former teen mom, is now going to be a grandmother thanks to her son becoming a teen dad. Let's take a look at this big announcement from Lauren Boebert. This is there's a lot here, okay?
I'm a mom of four boys. And I've said many times, Jason and I, we are raising our four boys to be men.
Okay.
Before liberals teach them to be women.
Okay.
But I leaned over and I asked my husband if it was appropriate to announce this here today. So I'm going to tell you all for the first time in a public setting that not only am I a mom of four boys, but come April, I will be a Gigi to a brand new grandson.
Wow. Even this crowd is sort of like, okay, yeah, kind of like a muted reaction, I have to say.
And Jason and I are so excited to welcome this new life into our family. Now, any of you who have young children who are giving life, there are some questions that pop up.
There are a hell of a lot of questions popping up based on what she's saying. That's for sure.
Fear that arises. Now, my son, when I approached him and told him, Tyler, I'm going to be a 36-year-old grandmother, he said, well, didn't you make granny a 36-year-old granny? I said, yes, I did.
Right.
He said, well, then it's hereditary.
That's pretty interesting, actually. There's actually a lot there. And here's an additional clip, again, where Lauren Boebert, she talks about this like it's a good thing. OK, and she wants to make it a cultural thing. She wants to talk about how great is it that the culture of life in red states leads to a high teen birth rate.
And, you know, there's something special about rural conservative communities.
Yes, there is.
They value life. If you look at teen pregnancy rates throughout the nation, well, they're the same in rural and urban areas. However, abortion rates are higher in urban areas, and teen mom rates are higher in rural conservative areas because we understand the preciousness of the life that is about to be born.
And you know, wow. So a few different things. Now, I don't want to make this into a cultural critique. There is a cultural critique here to be made, without a doubt, okay? But by their own claims, it's not really clear to me that these really are the pro-life values as exhibited by teens who get pregnant in red states not seeking abortions. I don't think that that's the great thing to celebrate that Lauren Boebert is making it out to be, because the most important thing to look at here is how do the kids of teen parents do in life? And the children of young mothers do notably less well in life. This is not about saying Lauren Boebert's grandkid deserves to do poorly. The grandkid, I would consider a victim in this situation. It's that the kid is not being well set up to succeed. When you look at outcomes of all sorts and types, poverty, how likely to graduate high school, all of these different things, you see the ideal outcomes when the parents, or usually the, what they're looking at is the mother, is at least 25 years old. And then from 20 to 25 year old moms, you see less good outcomes. And then when the mom is under 20, you see absolutely the worst outcomes. And the difference is significant. Now, this isn't about saying a 19-year-old can't be a good mom. Of course, that's not the case. This isn't about saying if you're 18 and you have a kid, you love the kid any less or whatever. It is not about that. But the younger the mother is, the higher the rate of poverty, the less likely the child is to graduate high school. You get the picture. But then we get not only to the weirdness of celebrating this when we know that statistically it's actually not a good thing. The hypocrisy here is that the way to prevent this, if you think it's not a good thing. Now, Lauren Boebert seems to be celebrating it. Okay, there is a cultural aspect to this. If you think this isn't a good thing, the way to prevent it is, of course, safe legal access to abortion. We know that. But teaching comprehensive sex education, that reduces teen pregnancy. It's been studied widely. Comprehensive sex ed reduces teen pregnancy. Lauren Boebert is against that. Lauren Boebert recently voted against funding that. And so there is that aspect to it as well, which is she is partially to blame. Certainly her movement is to blame for the creation of the circumstances that got us here in the first place. And by the way, Lauren Boebert also says that children should be forced to wait until they're age 21 to make decisions about just even what their gender expression is going to be. But having a baby at 17 is a great thing and is fine. That's also another one of these stunning hypocrisies. So listen, there, when we talk about different American cultures, this is one aspect that is very, very different. And to what degree some of what she's doing is a rationalization because the cake is baked, for lack of a better term, I don't know. But it is really, really wacky stuff. If you want to see Lauren Boebert deliver this news to this titillated crowd, all of these clips that I played will be on our Instagram, which you can find by searching Instagram for David Pakman Show. Today, we're going to be speaking with Alana Newhouse, who's the founder and editor-in-chief of Tablet Magazine. We're going to be talking about a term, brokenism, which I think is super interesting, and it sort of puts a different perspective on what, you know, maybe Alana, in our program, we often see as like a left-right political divide only, and that's the analysis we make, and we sort of don't go any further. You talk about brokenism and status quo-ism. Talk a little bit about how you first thought of this framework and what you mean by it.
Sure. So 2 years ago, I wrote a piece called Everything is Broken. In it, I tried to articulate what felt to me like an experience that not only I was having, but a lot of my readers were having, or a lot of people who I knew were having, which was the sense that a lot of the institutions in American life and society that we have to interact with, whether that's our kids' schools or health insurance companies, or the IRS, felt like they were not functioning properly. They felt broken. In the wake of that piece, I got a tremendous response to it. It was really incredibly gratifying. And one of the greatest parts of it was that I ended up getting emails from a bunch of people who became regular correspondents with me. And one of them became a friend, and his name is Ryan. And I talk about this in the beginning of the follow-up essay on brokenism, where at one moment, Ryan looked at me and said, you know, I don't even know what I am anymore. I don't know if I'm a Republican or a Democrat or if I'm a liberal or conservative. All I know is that I believe in in the basic premise of your piece, which is that things feel broken. And so I guess I believe in brokenism. And that kind of articulated an idea for me that I thought was very clarifying, because it felt to me like that actually was a thing that people believed from all over the spectrum. And so I tried to write a second piece that articulated what I thought a brokenness perspective on the world entailed.
You know, sometimes when I'll have a more detailed conversation with folks who have this general idea that there's a lot of things that aren't working, but they might identify as being on the political left or on the political right. One of the things I've experienced is that when you really get details from them about what are the ways in which some of these systems aren't working and what's your instinct about the solution, it seems to align much more closely with what we would be considered a left-wing view. Now, that may be my bias in who I'm talking to, but very often it will be the revelation I have that there's a lot of discontent with many systems, but a lot of people don't seem to realize that the solutions they are gravitating towards are actually more aligned with one side of political spectrum than the other. And that's sort of like a concern to me that people aren't acknowledging that. Do you experience the same thing when you talk to some of these folks, or is my view maybe partial or biased?
I think I probably experienced something a little different from you, but what I guess I would say is that one of the things that people talk to me about is not only the solutions that they're looking for, but also the diagnosis of the problem. And if in a funny way, if I could say what I think might be the case, even maybe for the people that you're talking to,
yes,
is that the solutions that they're grasping for, no matter what part of the spectrum they come from, end up being solutions that would be associated with the left. But the diagnosis of the problem sounds a lot like people from the right.
Mm.
And that's also interesting, right? Because then we can have a conversation that can be generative, where we can say, oh, okay, so maybe I come from the left, but I can talk to somebody from the right, because actually what we could agree on is what's causing some of these problems. Even if we disagree on what we would do to replace them. And that, to me, part of the reason why I set out this different way of seeing things is because also I was trying to get people out of their entrenched teams and get them talking to each other and finding the areas of the landscape on which they might agree.
One of the things that I've experienced at the anecdotal personal level when interviewing former extremists like KKK, neo-Nazi types, etc., is that they all tell a very similar story of the circumstances that made them vulnerable to getting pulled into these movements in the first place. And it's a lot of things that weren't working. It was a lot of broken things that were going on. Is this a broad, I mean, not everybody becomes a KKK member, obviously, or a neo-Nazi, but there seems to be a radicalizing effect of a lot of these things that just aren't working for people. Is that accurate?
I think it is. And I think the people who study extremism might find overlapping themes or events in some of what I write about. And, you know, it's part of what's a challenge here is a friend of mine actually wrote and said, you know, Alana, I sort of agree with you. I see what you're saying. But I mean, come on. Is it really monocausal? How did all of these institutions get broken at the same time? How is that even possible? So many of them started at different times. And so, of course, the answer is quite clear, which is technology. Like, we did have one thing happen. And if you actually look back to the Industrial Revolution, this exact same thing happened in society.
Hmm.
When you have an economic revolution that changes the means of how we live, it then comprehensively, almost in a cascade, changes all parts of life. It changes religion, communication, the postal service, like it changes everything. And as a result, we have to adjust. I think the same thing is happening now. All of our institutions were faced with the challenge of needing to embrace and adjust themselves to new technologies. Some of them adjusted better than others, and some of them are breaking under the pressure.
Yeah, Neil Postman wrote quite a bit about this in his books, Technopoly, and then also Amusing Ourselves to Death. And there's a sort of structural argument there about, you know, in linguistics, there's this idea. It's not, I don't know that it's completely universally accepted, but it's much explored that the language you speak actually impacts your worldview to some degree, based both on a combination of syntax and the culture surrounding it and the vocabulary. The technologies that we have, including social media or television or whatever, actually are deterministic to some degree about what issues make it into the news media or how do we approach problems or whatever the case may be. It's that sort of argument that would explain the timing, I think, of what you're talking about.
Yes. Absolutely.
So Neil Postman would say there's really no going back, and it's about how do you try to regulate in order to harness the parts we want, but to limit the parts that don't work so well. When we think about solutions, do you agree with that?
Yes. I think that part of the, and I've, in this interview, I've talked a lot about the brokenness perspective, but part of what I tried to do with the essay was also articulate the other perspective, the sort of warring perspective, which I also find incredibly compelling, which is the belief in what exists and the belief that what exists may or may not need some reforming or need some tweaking, but that you simply don't throw whole institutions or systems out the window, especially when those systems are the basket for people's needs. Sometimes in their safety and their livelihoods. Status quoists believe that we need to work very, very hard at fixing our current institutions. In a way, there's an incredibly inspiring and exciting conversation to be had if you put those two groups together. Because what you get is you say, oh, how about instead of fighting and trying to convince each other to join sides we're not going to join, what if together we look at the landscape and we almost assess, like do an assessment and say, what are the institutions that need reforming? What are the institutions that need radical reforming? And what are the institutions that need complete replacement? And let everyone do their part. Let the brokenists look at something and say, this is broken. I'm burning it to the ground and I'm starting again. And let the status quoists reform what might actually be salvageable.
The difficulty in that, as great as it sounds, is that there is a big divide about what's worthy of totally being destroyed and starting from scratch and what needs to be reformed. And you mentioned education. Last week in a 48-hour period, you had Candace Owens saying the solution to the U.S. being poor at math is breeding for math skills like the South Koreans do. And then 2 days later at CPAC, she says we should get rid of the Department of Education. It's like, you don't need to breed. You need to teach. But on the left, I think we would not say we need to get rid of the Department of Education. So it seems that the disagreement would come in which institutions fall under which of the two categories.
So you're right. And look, if the people that you're trying to create conversation with are people who are political rhetoricians, that's a challenge that's very different from my own.
Right.
I'm actually looking to create, to generate a conversation that feels fruitful among regular people.
Okay.
And people who actually are people who belong to the same town.
Right.
But who feel differently about the solutions or differently about the institutions of their world. And they're invested at a personal and granular level in those institutions. And they are not grandstanders who are just looking to make broad points. These are people who actually want to get their hands dirty. They just don't know in what way. They don't know if they want to get their hands dirty by completely abandoning their local school district because it's become too corrupt.
Right.
Or by reforming it, getting different people on the board. And those are decisions that actually do have to get made at a local level and do have to get made person by person, town by town, community by community. And then I think it generates trends nationally and maybe even internationally.
Super, super interesting. We've been speaking with Alana Newhouse, who's the founder and editor-in-chief of Tablet Magazine, and we'll link to the articles that we've been sort of talking about in this conversation. Alana, really appreciate your time and insights.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you thought Donald Trump's 2016 promises about a wall on the southern border that Mexico would pay for a beautiful new healthcare plan, ending the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and all of that stuff was unrealistic. If you thought that was far-fetched, the stuff that Trump is increasingly promising if he were to become president in 2024 is even more outrageous, and it includes flying cars. I know, it's truly a stunning thing, but that's what Trump is talking about. There's an exclusive Politico article. Trump calls for contest to create futuristic freedom cities, which says modern cities and flying cars might sound like the makings of an episode of The Jetsons, where a fictionalized family flew around an orbit city. For former President Donald Trump, it's the foundation of a new set of futuristic policy proposals. In a video set to be released Friday, Trump will call for a quantum leap in the American standard of living. He already talked about those freedom cities during his CPAC speech, which was pretty unhinged and basically sort of like a camp for homeless people. And Trump also is talking about technological elements. In another Politico article, it sort of expands on the flying cars idea. Trump calling for massive investment in vertical takeoff and landing vehicles, also known as flying cars. There is something really interesting here. Now, first and foremost, the right loves to say that the left promises unrealistic things. The things the left promises are only unrealistic insofar as Republicans are unwilling to actually fund them and insist that they're not things worth doing, including trying to get everybody health care or whatever the case may be. One of the really interesting things about flying cars is that it's very easy to visualize it. When you talk about, well, we're going to work hard to change the way that we power our homes and cars, so it's increasingly from wind and sun rather than, well, listen, I flipped on a light bulb. I don't know. It turned on. It doesn't feel that different if the source changes from being coal to being solar or whatever the case may be. And because it's less visual, it also doesn't really sound that worthwhile to put any money into it. Okay, so flying cars, extraordinarily visual. The other thing is that Trump does have this tendency to get obsessed with something without really understanding it. You might remember where there were a few speeches Trump gave, I think this was in 2020, where he became focused on going to Mars, even if he called it NARS.
The United States will be the first nation to land an astronaut on NARS.
Okay, I remember it like it was yesterday. So Trump does get fixated on some of this futuristic stuff as well. But the flying cars, the inclusion of flying cars is pretty damn interesting. Now, flying cars are also interesting because of the cultural importance of flying cars. Flying cars have been a sort of microcosm or emblematic of the future is now here. And if you look at things that were written in the 30s and 40s, and certainly you look at sci-fi in the 50s and 60s, lots of the things that Arthur C. Clarke wrote about 50 years ago have happened, satellites and different things. But flying cars as a sort of ubiquitous staple of the futuristic society has not developed nearly as quickly as some imagined that it would. And there's a lot of different reasons for that. One is, if you're going to have flying cars, they've got to be really, really safe. And of course, drone technology, the sort of quadcopter type technology, might offer some of the redundancies that would be needed for really safe flying cars. But also, listen, every time I'm on the highway, there's someone in the fast lane going 57 while on a cell phone. I don't know that I want to put those people in the air anytime soon. And so until the self-driving technology really matures, flying cars aren't going to be happening anytime soon. But the inclusion of it is certainly interesting. So a lot of cultural stuff to talk about when we talk about flying cars, and it is really interesting. Trump promising flying cars between 2025 and 2029, that is not a realistic promise, as I'm sure most of you realize. Tucker Carlson now seems to be sucking up to failed former President Donald Trump after the text messages were revealed in which Tucker admits to hating Trump passionately. This is very interesting. And I want you to remember that the number one priority, there's really two priorities for almost all in corporate media. Priority number one is ratings. And priority number two is maintaining access to the most powerful people you can possibly maintain access to. Despite the reality that Tucker Carlson hates Trump, quote, passionately, he doesn't want to be on the outs if Trump is again president of the United States. And so the day after his text messages attacking Trump were leaked, Tucker Carlson goes on TV and talks about all of the great ideas that Donald Trump is now proposing. Take a listen to this.
You wouldn't know it from watching the news media, but Donald Trump is running for president again.
Right. So first of all, the media isn't giving Trump enough attention.
Put him in prison first, which is, of course, their plan. And he's saying things that are really interesting.
Trump is saying interesting things. Wait, but you hate him passionately and you think he's an idiot.
Not rehashes at all. In fact, he's come out with a bunch of proposals that were so interesting that we thought that we would bring them to you. We've asked Fox's Kevin Cork to bring us the story.
Okay, so then he brings on Kevin Cork. And if you thought that Tucker was being sarcastic, because look, I just told you what the proposals are. It includes flying cars. If you thought that Tucker was kidding, he's not. This is a serious segment.
A good idea often begins with a very single thought. Tucker.
Kevin Cork, thanks so much. More babies, prettier buildings, cleaner parks. Those are achievable goals. Ones would improve everyone's life.
He's taking it seriously. Tucker is pretending like these are reasonable and good ideas. So this is very overt. Tucker now having to suck up to Donald Trump. And I don't know what happened behind the scenes when Tucker's text messages leaked saying he hates Trump passionately. It's completely plausible that Tucker and his producer and Fox brass got together and said, listen, I get it. You hate him. I get it. Listen, we all hate him. Maybe was even said behind the scenes, but he could be the president. And we want to host a primary debate and we want to host a presidential debate and we can't have Trump furious with us. And he's increasingly furious with us. So you got to go and clean this up. That's a completely plausible conversation that could have happened behind the scenes. These ideas, nicer buildings and flying cars and all this different stuff. If it were a Democrat that was proposing this stuff, Tucker Carlson would be doing his psychopathic laugh and talking about how unreasonable and expensive and unfair to the American taxpayer it would be to pursue these ideas. So don't fall for it. Tucker is trying to clean up his mess. It might actually work. Carrie Lake is now starting to do Trump's dirty work. She is pounding Ron DeSantis. We know Carrie Lake is desperate to be Donald Trump's vice president. We know that Carrie Lake is someone who is willing to do the dirty work. And she's so desperate to be Trump's VP. She can just taste it. She is now trying out by going on TV and attacking Ron DeSantis. Here saying, why would Ron DeSantis even consider running for president? He just was reelected. He should really be staying in Florida.
And the people of Florida just reelected him. I'm assuming when they reelected him, they were hoping he'd stay around for a while. So, I mean, I guess he's in his 40s. He's about 10 years younger than me. He's got a long political future ahead of him. And I think he should respect that the people just voted him in as governor and serve out that term for the people of Florida. And then he could obviously run for president. But this is President Trump's turn.
And yeah. So, and there's one more clip.
We haven't seen Ron DeSantis on the world stage yet. And you know, some of the people that are surrounding him are kind of the type of people that were pushing for war, that were pushing for the endless war.
And yeah. So a couple different things. First of all, I had to look that up. Ron DeSantis is 44 years old. When I look at DeSantis, I don't see a guy who's 5 years older than me. I see a guy who looks 15 years older than me. He's genuinely 44 years old. That's stunning stuff. I mean, that's an incredible, incredible thing to realize. And I'm going to have to process that probably a little bit later because it's bonkers. But the most important thing to understand is that the polling data supports the strategy of encourage everybody but Ron DeSantis to run against Trump, but try to keep Ron DeSantis out of the race. Why? When you look at Republican polling, DeSantis is the only person who polls well in a head-to-head matchup against Donald Trump. Trump crushes Nikki Haley in a head-to-head matchup. Trump really crushes everybody else, even people thinking of running who have not yet announced. But the more people you include in the polls, if you say, who would you support if it was Trump versus Nikki Haley versus Mike Pompeo versus Mike Pence versus Tim Scott, the more people you include, the better Trump does, because all those other people divide up support, except DeSantis. Trump genuinely would benefit from DeSantis not running. And so here is Carrie Lake trying out for Trump's VP and certainly willing to do the dirty work. Will it work to get her that VP slot? Axios report we talked about yesterday says that indeed Trump is considering her for his running mate. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. Here's a really good question about the Fox News text message scandal. Listen to this.
Hey, David, I just want to speak really briefly about the Fox News scandal. I know that you've been covering it really well, but I just have a comment. You know, I think that all of this stuff that's coming out in general simply won't have as big of an impact because the people that watch Fox News will never see it. In other words, the reason they haven't settled, which most people are like, why haven't they settled? This is very damaging to them. Because if they settle, they have to say to their audience, listen, we lied to you, and they probably have to say it 100 times a day. But the point is that they make more money doing it, and they know this. Therefore, why would they settle? They'll lose $1.6 billion. It'll hurt them.
So here's the thing. The caller is correct that a lot of, you know, we asked yesterday and the day before, are Tucker's viewers going to abandon Tucker because they're MAGA people and they watch Tucker with the idea that Trump's going to be praised by Tucker? And now Tucker is exposed in text messages saying he hates Trump passionately. Tucker's viewers just won't even hear about that story because Fox News isn't covering the story and they only watch Fox News. But there's another aspect to this. Even if the caller is right, that if Fox were to settle, they might have to do a mea culpa and say we were wrong, we lied about this and that. I don't even think their followers would care about that. I genuinely don't. I think they'd go, the liberal media forced them to do it. The liberal establishment forced them to do it. They didn't really lie. They told the truth. So I actually think the caller is wrong in that particular sense. Let me know what you think. We've got a great bonus show for you today. Sign up at joinpacman.com. Don't miss it.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Folks, glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet, because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
Mm-hmm.
nuclear holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
I want to start today with an explosive confrontation that took place during another one of these Republican Senate hearings. This particular confrontation involved unhinged Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, alongside Teamsters President Sean O'Brien. Teamsters, of course, a union. Republicans tend not to like unions. Republicans love to frame unions as sort of like mob entities.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The Chinese people have every right to ask, why does the U.S. talk at length about respecting sovereignty and territorial integrity on Ukraine while disrespecting China's sovereignty and territorial integrity on the Taiwan question? Why does the U.S. ask China not to provide weapons to Russia while it keeps selling arms to Taiwan?
As the Chinese parliament unanimously votes to give Xi Jinping a third 5-year term as president, tensions continue to escalate between the United States and China, in part over Taiwan. At the brink of war in the Pacific? That's the headline of a new piece by historian Alfred McCoy. We'll speak with him. Then, progressive Democratic Congressmember Barbara Lee was the sole vote against military action in the days after 9/11. Now she's running for the U.S. Senate.
I didn't quit when I refused to give the president completely unlimited war powers after September 11th, and in the face of countless death threats, I was the only no vote. I didn't quit then, and I won't quit now.
If elected, Congressmember Lee would be just the third black woman to serve in the Senate's 233-year history. We'll speak with her about President Biden's proposed $6.8 trillion budget that would increase military spending. She's introduced the People Over Pentagon Act to cut $100 billion from the military budget and reallocate funds to overlook priorities like health care and education. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's unveiled his $6.8 trillion budget proposal for the 2024 fiscal year. The plan would begin the process of trimming $3 trillion from the federal deficit over the next decade by raising taxes on wealthy individuals and corporations and allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices. Progressive groups praise the White House plan for investing in health care, housing, and the environment while expanding free community college, early childhood education, and child care. But Biden's budget also includes a request for a record-shattering $886 billion in military spending. Republican Speaker Kevin McCarthy has signaled Biden's budget will be dead on arrival on Capitol Hill. House Republicans have yet to unveil their own budget. Biden said Thursday he's prepared to negotiate with Speaker McCarthy at any time. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other leaders in Israel Thursday, where he called for an independent judiciary and for de-escalating tensions with Palestine, while reiterating the U.S.'s deep commitment to Israel's security.
But the United States also remains firmly opposed to any acts that could trigger more insecurity, including settlement expansion and inflammatory rhetoric. And we're especially disturbed by violence by settlers against Palestinians.
Secretary Austin also said he believed diplomacy was the best strategy when it comes to Iran and nuclear weapons. Israel's openly backed military action against Iran. Austin's visit comes against the backdrop of intensifying violence. Earlier today in the occupied West Bank, an Israeli settler shot dead a Palestinian man near an illegal settlement outside the city of Qalqilya. Separately, Israeli forces raided the town of Nilin near Ramallah overnight, arresting relatives of a Hamas gunman and ordering the immediate destruction of his family's home. Palestinians have condemned such demolitions as collective punishment. At least 79 Palestinians have been killed so far this year by Israeli military forces. The UN's humanitarian coordinator for Syria has condemned an airstrike by Israel on Aleppo International Airport earlier this week, which forced it to shut down, complicating humanitarian relief efforts as Syrians reel from last month's devastating earthquakes in the region. Here in the United States, a legislative push to end U.S. military interference in Syria through a war powers resolution was voted down Wednesday. The latest effort was led by